I'm that in the mid-1950s, when the census was taken in our country, and they were looking at the fastest growing religion in our country, that at that time we were at the top of the list. We no longer make the list. We're somewhere way down in the lower hundreds. But I'm also told that during that time that there's a story that I heard when I was a young boy. And it was about a time in Arkansas. And there was a trial in a little rural city of Arkansas. And they were getting ready to take the oath before they get up and give testimony in a trial where you put your hand on the Bible and you promise to tell the truth. And they couldn't find a Bible. And there was an older gentleman that was there in the courthouse that day. And he said, well, just find a Church of Christ member and put your hand on his head because he's the closest thing to a Bible that you'll ever see. And you know what? We were walking Bibles. But I'm afraid that's not true today. I'm afraid that many, many of God's people are not the kind of students and have not applied themselves to know and to be able to take the Bible and to rightly divide it and to be able to carry on an intelligent conversation about how the Bible is made up and what the Bible is all about. That has spurred me to do this special series of lessons that I began a few years ago when I went to the Philippines. And when I went to the Philippines, we were in a preacher training series. And in that series, we had young men for 12 hours a day for 30 days. And we gave them all kinds of information. And one of the things that we did is we taught them the meaning of each book of the Bible. It was called Survey of the Bible. And so I have taken this lesson from those lessons and this series in surveying the Bible book by book and understanding what's the general theme of that book, what's contained in that book, and so that we might have a better understanding of the Bible. And so we're going to begin that particular series tonight, and we'll do this from time to time until we get through the entire Bible, Old and New Testament. And as I told you this morning, if you would like copies of the slides of these classes, you let me know. I'll be glad to make them for you. And if you keep them, by the end, you'll have a little commentary on the entire Bible from beginning to end. Today, we want to talk about the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is exactly what it says in the very first book. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The book is about beginnings. It's the first book in the Bible. It was originally written in Hebrew and translated into Greek in 280 BC as part of the work of the Septuagint. Greek word meaning origin, source, and beginning. If you want to know the beginning and the source of life, of anything, you would have to go to this book. It tells about the beginning of many things. It was written by Moses around 450 BC. And it answers the question, where did I come from? There are three basic questions of life. Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? The book of Genesis answers the first question. Where did I come from? And so we understand, as we read in the creation account, that God spoke the world into existence. He said it was so, and it came to pass. We also understand that the world was created in six literal days. Not ages, not evolution, but in six literal days. Now, God could have created the world in 6 seconds. He didn't need 6 days. But as you read in the Bible, you read the evening and the morning of each day. The evening and the morning represent a 24-hour day. They're the same 24-hour days that we have today. About 8 or 9 years ago, there was a great debate, even among God's people, in whether or not these were really days, but whether they were ages. No, brethren, they weren't ages, they were days. And the Bible is very explicit on what was done. In day one, God created the light, and we have night and day. Day two, he placed a firmament, which is above the earth. In day number three, he separated the water and the land and the vegetable life. If you remember, if you read the Genesis account, it says there was void upon the face of the earth and it was darkness, and God gave that darkness and that void form. In day number four, he placed the sun, the moon, and the stars in the firmament. In day number five, he created the sea animals and the birds. And last but not least, on day six, he created the animals and he also created mankind. And you know on the seventh day that he rested. Now, I know, and you know, that that is a very brief account. We don't have a lot of detail. But the most important thing that we come to find out is that our origin began with God. And people have asked me, well, what was before God? Nothing was before God. God came first, and man came second. And so the creation is covered in the first two chapters of the book of Genesis. Everything God created was good. If you read in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 31, the Bible says that God looked after all that he created after he was done. And he didn't say it was good. He said it was very, very good. And so everything that God created was good. It was pristine. It was pure. It was clean. It was for man's benefit. And he gave man to have dominion over everything that he was everything that was created. And man was put in the position of authority. It was given to him by God. But then we have the beginning of sin. Adam and Eve lived in the Garden of Eden. They're placed in there. They're told to keep the garden and to take care of it. And in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, the marriage relationship is instituted. Father, man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That instituted marriage. Now, you know why that's important? God didn't put two men together. He didn't put two women together. He put a man and a woman together. That represents marriage, and that's what it was in the beginning, and that's still what it is today. It's the same way that God designed it in the beginning. Now, in Genesis chapter 2, God gave a law. It was a very simple law. It wasn't very difficult. God said in Genesis chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, of every tree that's in the garden, thou mayest freely eat. But of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that you eat of it, thou shalt surely die. Now I want you to notice in this law, it's very simple. There was a prohibition. They were told not to eat of a particular tree, and also God told them a punishment if that was failed to be obeyed. If they rejected that teaching and they did contrary to what he said, God made a consequence. That's called punishment. Now we know the story. The serpent appears and tempts Eve. Now if you read that account in Genesis chapter 3, you know what you'll find? She understood God perfectly. She told the serpent exactly what God had said. And all the devil did in verse number 4 is change one little word, and he added it, the N-O-T. God said you'll die. Satan says you will not die. But in the day of it that you eat of it, God will know that you'll become like God. And you'll be able to discern between good and evil. Now, was there a threat? Was there a threat of truth in what the serpent said? Yes. There's always a threat of truth in sin. That's the pull. That's the pull. But you notice that Eve, in verse 6, looked at the tree, and you know the avenue of sin? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. They are all there in Genesis 3:6. She saw that it was good for food. She desired it, and it was a desire to make one wise. And so she gave in to temptation, and she transgressed God's will. And that brought forth sin. And this is the birth of sin. And because of sin, everything changed, because sin has consequences. Now, you remember what Adam did. When God came in the garden of cooler day, he said, Adam and Eve were hiding. Why were they hiding? Because they were naked and they were ashamed. And God said, where art thou, Adam? And Adam said, I hid myself because I was naked. You remember what God said? Adam, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I commanded you not? And you remember what Adam did. He did what man's done from that day till this day. It wasn't me. It's that woman that you gave me. She gave me and I did eat. Well, Eve, it wasn't Eve's fault either. It was that serpent that you created. And that serpent tempted me and I did eat. And you know, when I was a little boy, I always felt sorry for that serpent. He had nobody to blame. He was at the bottom of the list. But you know what? If you read these passages very carefully, you know what you see? God punished the man, the woman, and the serpent. You know why? Because all of them were guilty. And that's the beginning of sin. And that's the beginning of all misery, all sickness, all illness, all difficulty, all tribulation, all everything that brings misery into our life. The door was open in the Garden of Eden. And it was done because man thought he was smarter than God. He was proven to be wrong. And he's been proven many times since to be wrong. And so sin is born. And man experiences spiritual death. Now, what did God say? Now, this is important. What did God say would happen in the day that they ate of it? Not later, not sometime in the future, in the day that you ate of it, they would surely die. Did they die that day? Yes. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, they were driven out of the Garden of Eden and from the presence of God. And brethren, that's what death means. It means separation. When is it physical? When is it spiritual? Context. Context. You know, there is a religious group among us that believe that every time you see death in the Bible, it means physical. No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean it there. In there, it means spiritual. What about Romans 6:23? The wages of sin is death. Is that physical death? If it is, none of us ought to be here tonight. We all ought to be dead. But that's not death. That's not physical death. That's spiritual death. And that passed on to all men. And you know what we inherited from Adam? We didn't inherit the sin. We inherited the consequences when we do the same thing. When we commit sin, there is a consequence, and that consequence is spiritual death. That is the only thing that we inherited from Adam. We did not inherit his sin. We did not inherit his condemnation. We inherited that we commit sin, that we will be separated by God from him because of sin. But you say, preacher, didn't we inherit something from him? Yes, one thing. One thing. Death. What did God put in front of the tree of life? A flaming sword so man could not ever attain it again. And so, you remember the punishment that was given to Adam? What was he told in Genesis 3:19? For dust thou art, and dust thou shalt return. That was a punishment, and that passed on to all men. Read Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. We inherited physical death. We're all going to die. We're not going to live on the earth forever. But we did not inherit Adam's sin. You can't inherit another man's sin. You only inherit that which you commit yourself. And so this is the birth of sin. And then sin increases in the land. Cain slew Abel. Why? Jealousy. You know, if you read Genesis chapter 4, there's no record of the instruction on what kind of sacrifice to offer to God, whether it was animal or grain or some other thing. There's no instruction there. But you know, when we read Hebrews 11 and verse 4, why was Abel's sacrifice more acceptable than Cain's? Because the Bible says he offered it by faith. What does it mean, he offered it by faith? Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. God could not have condemned him unless he had violated his instruction. And so he slays his brother Abel because of jealousy. And we have the first murder. And then Lamech practiced polygamy. We have the first case of multiple wives. And that caused all kinds of problems throughout God's history. We also see where it mentions one man. This man is mentioned in one verse of the Bible, Enoch. And it says, he walk with God. And he was not, for God took him. Now what does that mean? That means that he didn't experience physical death on earth. He did die. He had to die because flesh and blood can't inherit the kingdom of heaven. And in the Hadean state, but he is one of the two people mentioned in scripture that did not experience physical death. We also see in Genesis chapter 6 that Seth's descendants, and that's the one that was born after the death of Cain, the descendants began to intermarry with Cain's wicked descendants, and they became very wicked. And God looked down upon the world, and he saw that it was evil continually. I wonder what God sees when he looks down on the world today. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. You know, this is the first time that grace is used in your Bible. In Genesis 6 and verse 8. Why did he find grace in God's eyes? I can tell you why he found grace in God's eyes. Because when he was given the instructions to the ark that we'll talk about in a minute, it says in verse 22 of that chapter, thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. He obeyed God. That's why he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Then we have the flood account. The instructions for building the ark are in chapter 6, 13 through 22. Noah entered the ark when he was 600 years old in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11. It rained on the earth 40 days, covering the highest mountain, according to chapter 7, verse 17 through 20. It water remained on the earth for 1 year and 10 days, 375 days. And in Genesis chapter 9, we have the rainbow given as a sign of God's promise that he would never again destroy the world with water. The flood account. Did it really happen? How do you explain fossils? What are fossils? Fossils are things that are imprinted or embedded into the minerals of rock by pressure. Where did that pressure come from? From the water. Water that covered the whole earth for a period of many, many days. And you know, there are many people today that accept the biblical account of the flood. More and more people are accepting it in the scientific realm because there's too much evidence to deny it. But I want you to notice something. Something changed after the flood. How long man lived changed. Remember those genealogies in Genesis chapter 5? Remember Methuselah? He lived 969 years. Remember Adam? He lived 930 years. But you know what all those people have in common in Genesis 5? They had this simple thing said about every one of them. And they died. No matter how long they lived, they died. But after the flood, men don't live that long anymore. The years change. Now, scientists can give you a long list of why that's so, but the one that really only knows that is God. But man did live shorter periods of time after the flood in Genesis 6 through 9. Now, that led us to Genesis 11. All nations that now exist obviously descended from Noah and his children. What were they told to do when they left the ark? Go and replenish the earth. But they didn't do that. They stayed in one place. They didn't scatter. God told them to scatter and replenish the earth, but they didn't do that. They stayed there. And then you have Shem. He's the Arameans and the Arabians. You have Ham, the Ethiopians, the Egyptians, and the Canaanites, and there are other nationalities. And then you got Japheth, which is Indo-European, the Greeks, the Medes, etc. All men come from one of these three men. All of us are descendants from Noah in some way. And so these are the nations as we know them today. But they really began in Genesis chapter 11. All people lived together and spoke one language. They had a common language. And they wanted to make a name for themselves. Imagine that. Men wanted to make a name for themselves. Kind of sounds like 21st century, doesn't it? They wanted to make a name for themselves. So how are they going to do that? They're going to build a tower and it's going to reach up to the heavens. Well, you know, God looked down on that and thought, well, you know, they have a common language and whatever they set their hand to do, they're going to do it. I need to do something about that. And so what he did is God confused their language. What happened if you have different languages? You cannot communicate. If you can't communicate, you're not going to get anything done. It's going to be chaos. But you know what that language barrier did? It made them scatter. And so you have the birth of nations. They scattered and the nations began. And so that is how the nations began. And our one family, Shem, Shem's descendancy is the lineage of which Christ will come through. But that leads us to a very important chapter in Genesis. And it is what I call a pivotal chapter in the Bible story. It is Genesis chapter 12. And it is the beginning of the story of Abraham. And Abraham's life is a very important part of God's story. You see, Abraham lived with his father in Terah in Ur. And God called Abram in Genesis chapter 12 and called him to leave his home, to leave his family, to leave everything he knew and to go to a land that God would show him. But in so, God gave him three great promises. And those promises are a capsule version of the entire story of the Bible. The entire Bible story is going to be told in the fulfillment of those three promises. Those three promises are the nation promise, the land promise, and the seed promise. The first two will take place in the Old Testament. The third will take place in the New Testament. And when the famine struck, Abram and Sarai moved to Egypt, and Sarah lies about she being Abraham's sister instead of his wife. And that caused a great deal of problem. And so this man is promised these great promises. And if you continue the story in chapter 13, great strife becomes between Abram and his nephew Lot. And Lot was given first choice. This shows the character of Abraham. Abraham was the oldest. Abraham was the eldest. He's the one that should have got to choose first. But we see Abraham's character, and that he wanted no strife with Lot. So he said, Lot, you go to the left, and I'll go to the right. You go to the right, and I'll go to the left. He gave him first choice. And you know what? Lot looked and saw that the water was better towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and that's what he chose. And so he went towards Sodom and Gomorrah, the plain cities, and Abram went the other way. Now Lot is taken captive in the battle of the kings, and Abram goes rescues him in Genesis 14. Now that seems like a little side trip, but it's not. Because in this, we read the story of Melchizedek. Now when we read this story, it really doesn't have a lot of significance. But you know what? You remember this man's name. You're going to see it again. You're going to see it in Hebrews. Because Melchizedek is the order of the priesthood of Jesus Christ. He's not after the Aaronic priesthood. He's after the priesthood of Melchizedek. Why Melchizedek? Because if you read the account in Genesis 14, Melchizedek has no genealogy. No beginning, no ending. He was a prototype. He was a shadow of what would come with Christ, who would have no genealogy, physical genealogy, since he was the Son of God. Abraham and Sarah were well advanced in years and they had no child. Abraham was promised that he would have a descendant, an heir, when he was 75 years old. 11 years has passed and he hasn't got a child. And so, the promise would be fulfilled in later generations. That's what God tells Abraham in Genesis 15. But Sarah wants to help God out. It's been 11 years. It's obvious you're not going to have a child by me. So I'll give you my handmaiden Hagar. You can take her for wife, and you can raise seed in her, and you can bring yourself an offspring. And brethren, there's a very important lesson about this. God doesn't need our help. It is never help when men try to help God. That has always caused more problems. How much problem did that cause? How much problem did Ishmael cause for God's people? Ishmael was born, but he was not the child of promise. Who are Ishmael's descendants? The Arabs. Are they still fighting the Jews today? I think they're still fighting today, aren't they? And that would have never happened had Sarah not tried to help out God. She tried to help out God, and that turned out to be a disaster. And it ended up Ishmael and Isaac parting ways because of Sarah's anger at Ishmael making fun of her son Isaac. So that didn't work. You know, every person today that wants to make the homosexuality a moral issue wants to forget about the story of Genesis 19. But Genesis 19 is an important principle story because it gives us God's attitude about this thing called homosexuality. The cities of the plain became morally corrupt. They desired to have carnal relations with the men under Lot's rule. You know what secular the history says? You know what some religions say was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah? They were not hospitable. No. Go and read the account. And you know what it says in Genesis 19? Remember when Lot had the strangers in the house and the men surround the house? And he said, send out the men who came to visit you that we might know them. In the Hebrew it says, we might know them. What does that mean, that they might know them? That's the same word that's used in Genesis chapter 4 when it says Adam knew his wife Eve and she conceived Seth. What that means is they wanted carnal relations with them. What is that? That's homosexuality. Just read the context. That's what it means. It's not my interpretation. That's what it means. And God made a statement about how he felt about that. Only Lot's family escaped. Lot's wife became a pillar of salt. There's a principal lesson in that. Don't look at the clock. Don't turn your head back. I remember one church I did a meeting for in California. I had a big sign above the clock that said, remember Lot's wife. I always loved to preach at that place. She became a pillar of salt because she disobeyed God. Isaac's birth. When Abraham was 99, God confirmed with the promise that next year at this time, him and Sarah would have a son. And in Genesis 21, he is born. His name is Isaac. He becomes a very important player in God's plan. Abraham's name changed to Abraham, and Sarai's name changed to Sarah in chapter 17. Abraham's faith is tested in Genesis 22. Of all the things that I've read about in the Bible, I guess Genesis 22 is one of the most difficult for me to comprehend. Because it's about Isaac and Abraham. Abraham waited 100 years for that son. He had him about 12 years. God tells him in Genesis 22, he says, Abram, here I am, Lord. Abraham, I want you to take Isaac. I want you to take him up on Mount Moriah. And I want you to offer him there as a sacrifice for me. Now, you know what? I got children. And I got a son. And if I was Abraham and God asked me that, I think I'd try to negotiate my way out of that to try to him take me instead of my son. Or I might have some questions. Wait a minute. You promised me that son. You told me that you gave it to me. You gave it to him. Now you take him away from me. But you know what the most remarkable thing about Genesis 22 is? Abraham said none of that. He said, he told his servants, you stay here with the animals. Me and the lad will go up yonder and we'll be back. You know why I've read that? I read that 100 times before I read that word, we'll be back. We'll be back. What does that tell you about Abraham? That tells you about Abraham's faith. How long a 3-day journey do you think that was to get to the top of that mountain? Knowing what he was going to do when he got there. But he passed his test. He passed his test and he was about to take Isaac's life. And God said, do thy son no harm. For now I know that you love me. And he looked over at the thicket and there was a ram. You know, I've heard preachers at other denominations say that Abraham would have never killed Isaac. You better go back and read the text. He bound his hands, his feet, took the knife, and he would have slayed him except God stopped him. But you know, Don't you wonder how he could do it? How did he have that kind of faith to do that? I want you to take your New Testament, and God's book tells us how Abraham did that. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, and look at verse 17. You know, this is one reason that if you don't have an understanding of the Old Testament, there's statements in the New Testament, you're not going to understand what they mean. Look at verse 17. By faith, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, in whom it was said, in Isaac, your seed shall be called. Concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he had received him in a figurative sense. You know what that means? That means even if God allowed him to take his life, Abraham knew that God would again give him life because God promised that the seed promise would go through Isaac. You know what that demonstrates? That's why he's called the father of faith. Because he had unwavering faith. He had faith that didn't flinch when God commanded him things. Genesis 23, Sarah dies at 120 years old. She's buried in a cave at Mount Per near Hebron. That will become important later in the Bible story. Rebekah is chosen to be Isaac's wife in Genesis chapter 24. He does not want her to take a wife of the land. And so he goes back to his homeland and he takes Isaac's wife is now Rebekah. Abraham died when he was 175 years old in Genesis chapter 25. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. They become very important in the Bible story. Isaac was partial Esau. Rebekah was partial Jacob. Parents, learn something. Don't ever show partiality with your children. Every time we see an example of this in the Bible, it caused nothing but problems. Don't be partial to your children. They're different, but they're still your children. The older would serve the younger. That was determined when they were born. Remember when they were born, he grabbed his heel. The older would serve the younger. That's exactly backwards to Hebrew custom. Esau sold his birthright. Oh, great lesson in that. Great lesson in that. We better understand the value. You know, we have a birthright. Our birthright is when we obeyed the gospel, we became a Christian. That gave us a birthright. Would you sell your birthright for a bowl of beans? That's what Esau did. Isaac, because he was deceived, gave the blessing to Jacob. Now, Jacob and Esau and Abraham were important men in God's story. But did these men have their own flaws? Yeah. Abraham lied about Sarah twice. Isaac deceived his father to receive the blessing. He made his brother sell him his birthright when it was his responsibility to feed his brother if he was hungry. Brethren, these men weren't perfect. These were men that God used to enact his plan and unveil it. They were normal men with frailties. But they had a degree of faith that led them to recover from their mistakes. Jacob fled. And Esau took a Canaanite wife because he saw that it would anger his parents. Now, that leads us to Jacob's life. The covenant made at Bethel. He wrestles with the angel all night, remember? And Jacob marries Leah and Rachel. You remember that story, don't you? He saw Rachel. He said, whoever comes, let it be the one that comes and asks me to give me a drink of water. That be the one that you want me to marry. And it was Rachel. And remember, Laban said, you worked for her for 7 years. Now, husbands, think about that. If your father-in-law tells you, you can take her for your wife, but you got to work 7 years for her. You know what the Bible says about that? That he worked, but it seemed a few days because of the love that he had for her. What a wonderful story. And then, the night of his marriage, he's deceived by Laban. And he's given Leah instead of Rachel because Leah is older. And it was a custom that the older could not be given, or the younger could not be given before the older. So he's given Leah. And he said, Laban, you deceived me. And he says, but if you work another 7 years, I'll give you Rachel. And he worked another 7 years. So he worked 14 years to get the woman he loved. And it didn't matter to him. Jacob had children, didn't he? Had more than one, too, didn't he? Leah had six. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and a daughter, Diane. You seen those names before? I think you see them every Wednesday night when we go through, when we talk about the 12 sons of Israel, don't we? Zebulun, Leah's handmaiden, Gad and Asher. Bilhah, Rachel's handmaiden, Dan and Naphtali. And Rachel's children, Joseph and Benjamin. You count them up, it's 12. And those 12 sons become very important in the Bible story. They become the nation of Israel. That's promise number one as God begins to unveil it. Jacob becomes wealthy and Esau receives him back in Genesis chapter 34. But you know what the rest of the Genesis account is? It's an ongoing biography about one man. From chapter 37 to chapter 50, it is the longest running biography about any person save Jesus Christ. Who is that man? Abraham? Look at all the great men that lived in the Bible. Abraham, Noah, Jacob and Esau. But it wasn't them. It was this son, Joseph. Joseph's life is depicted. Joseph was a favorite son. Why? Because he was the son of Abraham's old age. And Joseph had the ability to understand dreams. And remember, he had a dream where he saw all these sheaves bowing down to Joseph. Remember that? It made his brothers angry. And they hated him. Because not only did his father favor him, they called him a dreamer. And so it caused them to hate him. And his brothers sold Joseph into slavery in Genesis chapter 37 to a band of Ishmaelites. Oh, I wonder who they're a descendant of. And then he ended up in Egypt. In Potiphar's. The brothers told Jacob that Joseph was dead. Remember they took his coat of many colors, dipped it in blood, and said, Dad, do you know whose coat this is? You know they let their dad believe for 17 years his son was dead. Joseph ended up as the head of Potiphar's house in Egypt in Genesis 37. And Jacob's name was changed to Israel in Genesis chapter 35. That's important because that becomes the name of the nation. He's held in a place of honor in Potiphar's house. He's falsely accused and imprisoned. Why? Potiphar's wife noticed that Joseph was a good-looking young man and she wanted him to commit adultery. And he rebuffed her. Think about this for a moment. Who would have known? Nobody was there. Who would know? You remember what Joseph said about that? He said, how can I do this great sin first against God and then against my master who has put everything in this house under my hand save you because you are his wife? He was a young man that understood about principle and had character and did not give in to what would have been easy to give in to. Think about it. He was sold into slavery. He was somewhere he didn't want to be. He's separated from his family. They think he's dead. He's in a foreign country. And this wonderful, good-looking woman wants him to commit adultery. Who's going to know? Character. Character is built in adversity. That's what we learn about Joseph. He prospers in prison. The gatekeeper gives all the prisoners to him and he prospers. Everything Joseph does, it goes well with him. And people begin to notice that. And then there was a butler and a baker. And I love this story. Because they have a dream and they're upset. And Joseph knows they're upset and goes, what's the matter? Well, we had this dream and we don't know what it means. He says, well, tell me the dream and God will give you the interpretation. So you remember the baker? You remember the butler's dream? He told him about three, he saw these grapes and these vines, and He says, well, that means in 3 days you're going to be restored to your position. And you're going to take the grapes in your hand and you're going to squeeze them in the cup and you're going to be in the household of your king again. Can you just see the baker? All right. What about me? His is not so good. In 3 days, your neck's coming off your head's coming off your shoulders, and you're going to be hung, and the birds are going to eat your flesh for food. How do you think the baker felt when the butler got out on the king's birthday and was restored to his former position? It happened just like Joseph said, didn't it? And you know, what did Joseph ask the butler to do? Don't forget about me here. Isn't this just like people? You do a favor for him, he said, now don't forget about me. And he forgot about Joseph for 2 more years. Now let me ask you something. Wouldn't that make you bitter? Couldn't that have the effect of making you very bitter? Didn't make Joseph bitter. He just continued to be faithful. And then Pharaoh has a dream. And none of his wise people can figure out what the dream means. And they're beside themselves. He doesn't know what these 2 dreams mean. But you know what happened? What happened is the butler gets his memory back. He says, I know somebody can tell you a dream. He's down there in your prison. And he told him the story about the butler and the baker. And he said, he rightly told me I'd be restored and the baker would be hanged. And they hurry up and get him up there. And he comes before him in chapter 41 and he tells them exactly what the meaning of the dream is. What happened because of that? Remember what the dream was? 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty. The land's going to overproduce for 7 years and then it's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And so Joseph says, here's what you do. You take a part of all that overproduce and you build storehouses and you store that up for when the years of famine come. And you know what Pharaoh says? Hey, that's a great idea. Who am I going to put over that? Joseph. You know what this is a story of, brethren? The providence of God. Joseph ends up in Egypt. He ends up second in command. And he has rule over all of Egypt except in the throne of Pharaoh. Think about that. And who's got to come down because there's no grain in Canaan? Joseph's brothers. And when they come to see Joseph, who is the governor of the land, what do all those brothers do when they come before Joseph? They bow down before him. Remember that dream he had in Genesis chapter 37? Now it's come to pass. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. And so, he returns their money and keeps Simeon until they bring back Benjamin. Remember, Jacob wouldn't let him take Benjamin, because he was the only one left of Rachel's children, and he didn't want to lose him, so he stayed back in Canaan. But they said, now I got Simeon, and unless you bring back your brother, I'll keep Simeon. And so, they return with Benjamin to buy more grain in chapter 43. Joseph reveals himself. Think about this. They go to his house for a feast, and he sets them in their place. The oldest first, all the way to the youngest. And had them exactly in order. Wouldn't you think that'd be strange? I think that'd be strange. Joseph sends wagons to bring Jacob back to Egypt. And when they come back to Egypt, how many of them are there? 70. And you know what God does with those 70 souls? He begins the fulfillment of the first promise, of the nation promise. And that's how they ended up in Egypt. And when they come to Egypt, they settle in the land of Goshen, the best part of Egypt. And Joseph has all the money and the land, and the people gave him for the grain. They ran out of money, then he bought their land. When they could no longer have any land, then he hired them out as servants. everything belonged to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's getting pretty rich, isn't he? He's getting pretty powerful, isn't he? He's getting very prominent, and that's going to play right into God's hand. Israel makes Joseph promise to take his body out of Egypt. Think about this. Joseph is dying, and he makes his sons promise that when you leave Egypt, not if, when, you take my bones out of here, do not leave me here. Now, does that tell you something about Joseph's character and what he thought about God's promise? Israel blesses Joseph and all his other sons in chapter 48 and 49. Israel dies and is buried in chapter 50, and the Egyptians make great lamentation over his father's burial. His brothers are afraid that Joseph will now pay them back for their evil. And if you want the second greatest story of forgiveness in all of the Bible, this is the first. The only one that tops it is the one that Jesus does when he forgives our sin. Here Joseph is in power, in control, with the ability to pay back his brothers for the evil they did him. And do you remember what Joseph said? Am I in the place of God? Brethren, let those words burn in your mind. We are not God. We do not take vengeance. We don't reckon the books, and we don't balance the scales. That's God's business. And he said, you did evil, thinking it was for evil, but God meant it for good to send me ahead of you to preserve life. That's how God's providence works. God took the evil actions of Joseph's brothers and put Joseph in a position, because of his character, because of his unwavering faith, to be in a position to protect God's people and to make sure that they would remain together. And that's how they got in Egypt. And now they're in Egypt, and that will lead us to Exodus and how they come out. Brethren, that's the book of Genesis. And you know what's important? It's a piece of the puzzle. But it's an important piece because it's the first piece. It tells us how everything began. And you know what? When we get through with the Bible, you're going to have a very clear picture how God revealed his plan through time to bring us to where we're at right now. And all of this was done in Genesis. And everything else that we will study was done for one reason. To bring Christ to this earth, to hang on a cross, to die for the sins of mankind, that we might have redemption and forgiveness of sin. Everything in the Bible story is done for that event to take place. And every book that we go through tells us another piece of the puzzle. And that's why the whole Bible is important to understand. We don't want to end this service without giving you an opportunity. You know, I love to study the Bible. It is such a remarkable book. It is so remarkable how God unfolded his plan over the history of the world. And it is a wonderful story. And men need to know it. And we may be the only one that can tell them. And so we need to understand it. By the way, how are you going to talk to a Jew if you don't understand the Old Testament? That's all they believe. How are you going to ever convert them if you don't have a working knowledge of the Old Testament? That's why we study it. Because we need to rightly be able to divide it. If you're here and you're not a Christian, we want to give you an opportunity to become one. If you're here and you're not lived your life in a way that's acceptable to God, you need the prayers of the church on your behalf. We'll pray with you and for you that God will forgive you. If we can do anything for you tonight to help you in your spiritual condition, we bid you to come forward as together we stand as we sing.